May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dreyer, attorney registration number 19637, and I represent the plaintiffs. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if possible. The plain and unambiguous language of the Innovation Schools Act does not authorize the defendants to create from scratch brand new innovation schools where Colorado teacher employment laws and duly negotiated collective bargaining agreements may be thrown out the window from day one. What the statute authorizes is the establishment of innovation schools at pre-existing schools where the consent of teachers and others is obtained prior to converting the schools into innovation schools.
So is your position that the approval must come from teachers at schools that will no longer be in existence rather than at the schools that are being created?
Yes, Your Honor. The plain language of the statute says that a school, an existing school, may, with or without the collaboration of the school board, develop and submit a plan to a local board of education for approval of an innovation designation. The statute does not say that a local school district or a local school board may create an innovation school. If the legislature had wanted to authorize school districts to simply create new innovation schools from scratch, it would have said so. The legislature would have written the statute to say something like, a school board or a school district may develop and implement a plan to create one or more innovation schools. But the legislature did not say that. It specifically said a school, an existing school, may develop and submit an innovation plan for approval.
But the approval is to be obtained from teachers and staff employed by the innovation school. Isn't that correct from the statutory language?
The vote is to be taken of these teachers at the school where the plan to turn it into an innovation school is being submitted. The idea is to get to find out whether or not the teachers at the school approve the innovation plan. It's not simply a matter of getting buy-in. That would mean that the only thing that matters is whether the teachers who end up working at the school agree with the innovation plan. That's not what the legislature said. The legislature could have written the statute to say just that, that each innovation school shall ensure that the teachers who are employed at this school agree with the innovation designation, but they didn't say that. What they said was a school is to submit a plan, and that plan is required to contain evidence that majorities of the teachers and administrators at the school approve the innovation plan. The statute requires that to be submitted before the innovation plan is approved. So that obviously means it's the teachers at the pre-existing pre-innovation school, because otherwise you couldn't be submitting it before the innovation plan is approved if the teachers who are voting are people who aren't hired until afterwards. The statute was clear.
Excuse me. Why would the legislature have wanted teachers who wouldn't be working at the new school to be voting, to be expressing that view?
They might be working at the new school. It was their role to decide whether or not this school would be converted into an innovation school. That's the purpose of the statute. A genuine vote, not just a rubber stamp to make sure that everybody is on board with the innovation proposal. It was supposed to be a genuine vote of the teachers at the school to decide whether or not the school would go ahead with the innovation plan. If the majority of the administrators and the teachers did not vote in favor of the plan could not be pursued. And in fact, that's exactly how the statute was implemented during the first 2 years it was in effect in the Denver public schools.
Doesn't the district have the power to simply close a school without regard to the Innovation School Act?
They do, Your Honor, and then they can open a new school, and after that new school is opened, Your Honor, then they can that school can decide to follow the Innovation Act and apply for innovation status. Once the new school is opened, they can go through the process to take a poll of their teachers, of their administrators. They're also supposed to get evidence of support from parents and students, and all of that is supposed to be used to make the determination whether or not to go forward with the plan.
But suppose the school is just closed, it's just shut down, so that there's no school, there's no operating school, and then later the district wants to set up an innovation school there in that location to replace that school. whose vote is solicited at that point to determine whether or not the teachers and administrators of that school agree with opening an innovation school?
Well, the school needs to open first as a non-innovation school, and then what the statute says, once they exist, because, you know, a school that doesn't exist can't submit a petition.
Where does the statute say that the school has to open first as a non-innovation school?
It says that a school may prepare and submit an innovation plan. A school may do it, not the Board of Education, not the school district. A school has to be the initiator under the statute. This statute was a compromise. The legislature did not enact the statute exactly the way the school district wanted the statute to be enacted. The legislative process, the undisputed legislative process, is there were compromises made. There were two basic interest groups involved in the legislative process. There were the school districts, who wanted complete and unlimited flexibility to do whatever they wanted in terms of setting up innovation schools. And then there was another interest that the legislature considered, and those were the teachers and the teachers' representatives. And they wanted to protect the employment rights of teachers and other employees.
Wasn't there a third interest involved, that of the students?
I am not aware of a lobbying group for the students being actively involved in the legislature.
And is it essential there be a lobbying group before a law can be adopted?
No, it's not essential, but in fact, that's the way it occurred, and there were compromises made, and that's what the legislative process involves. There were this statute is a carefully crafted and deliberately crafted compromise between the interests of the school districts and what they wanted, and the interests of the teachers and what they wanted, and the legislature drew that compromise in this statute. The language of the statute embodies that compromise, and that should be respected by the courts. It's not the role of the courts to upset the compromise that the legislature came up with. The compromise gave the schools some of what they wanted and gave teachers some of what they wanted. It said schools do have the right to seek designation as innovation schools where the collective bargaining agreement and statutes will not be followed, but the consent of majorities of the teachers and administrators at the school is required before that can be done. That was put in there because the teachers insisted on that kind of language. Also, there was language that there
can
has
I,
to
excuse
be...
Excuse me, can I just want to ask you a question?
Yes.
About, you keep saying the school, and so I take it when you say the school, you mean the old school that's being closed, not the innovation school that's being put together.
Well, it's not necessarily being closed. There's an existing school, and if people at that school decide that they want to turn that school into an innovation school, the statute sets up a process for that school to submit a plan to the school board. The statute does not address at all the idea of creating a brand new innovation school from scratch. Nowhere does it say that a school district can create an innovation.
Let's go back to my question. I think Judge Berger asked you a question about whether or not the schools had already been closed. And I thought you answered that there already made a decision made to close the schools. Is that correct?
Yes, schools were closed, but there were some of these schools, although they were closed, there were new schools opened on the same campuses, kind of to service the same geographic area as the pre-existing schools. So there were groups of teachers at these pre-existing schools who lost their positions when those schools were closed, and the new schools were then opened on the same campuses or in the same geographic areas.
But they lost their jobs for reasons unrelated to the innovative schools. They lost their jobs because the decision was made to close the schools.
In some of the cases, I'm not certain whether there was a gap between the closing of the schools and then the reopening, but the problem is the statute requires a school, before they submit their innovation plan, to make sure that they have majority consent of the teachers and the administrators to turn the school into an innovation school. What the school district did here, in terms of trying to comply with that consent requirement, actually makes a mockery of the word consent. Let me explain how they got
before their consent. Before you go there, what possible reason would the legislature have for saying that if there's no school there before, that you can't set up an innovation school?
Because
what was the reason for that?
The reason was because of the interests of employees and teachers who advocated in the legislative process and argued that this would mean basically that the school district could create a whole bunch of schools from scratch where the Colorado state laws don't apply, where the collective bargaining agreement doesn't apply, without getting permission to convert into a school like that, you start from scratch.
But only if they consent. They have to give their consent by that vote.
And that's exactly what I was going to address right now. What the school district did was, when they hired people for these innovation schools, they told all of the applicants that this was an innovation school, that the contract would be waived, that the statutes would be waived, and if they didn't want to work in a school with those kinds of terms and conditions, they should not be employed at these schools. And the contracts that they signed specifically said they were agreeing to these waivers and agreeing to the innovation school as conditions of their employment. So every person who essentially voted against the innovation school by not agreeing to work at the school, their votes were not counted at all. The only votes that were counted were the ones of the people who agreed with the innovation plan by working at the school. The same thing with the vote that later took place on the collective bargaining agreement waivers. The only people who got to vote on those waivers were people who had previously signed an agreement saying that they agreed to the waivers. Everybody who didn't agree to it was prevented from voting because they didn't get the opportunity to vote. That is not a genuine vote when you only count the people whose votes agree with your side. The statute wanted a contemplated
real vote. I understand your argument when you're talking about an existing school, but if you have a brand new school that has no predecessor whatsoever, I don't understand why it wouldn't be sufficient and why it wouldn't make legislative sense to say, okay, we're going to condition the waiver of the collecting bargaining agreement provisions upon that vote.
Association, in its role in the as an advocate and a lobbyist in the legislature, argued to the legislature that this association would not agree to that, because that would mean that people are being required as a condition of their employment to agree to waivers. That's not a free and voluntary vote. A free and voluntary vote is when you say to someone, you can vote either way, and the results of this vote will determine whether or not we waive the collective bargaining agreement. But in this case, the only people that got to vote were people who had already signed contracts saying they agreed to the waiver. That's not a fair vote, and that's not what the statute contemplated, and it's not what the legislature passed. The legislative statute is a compromise, and what the school district is trying to do is get a better bill than they were able to get out of the legislature. They want this court to write them a better law than they were able to get through the legislative process, because the legislative process gave teachers something in return for what they were taking away.
Council, I'm concerned about your statement that this is not a free and voluntary vote. They don't like the terms. You can apply somewhere else.
Then, that's but their votes count. Only the votes of the people who agreed were counted.
But those votes were cast free and voluntarily.
But if you exclude from the voting process everyone who disagrees before, it's a pre-selected group of people selected on the basis of their willingness to agree to the waivers. The only people who got to vote on the waivers were people who previously had signed an agreement to agree to the waivers. Everybody who didn't agree with the waivers, their vote was not counted.
But that's a different issue from whether their votes are free and voluntary.
No, it is. No,
if they don't like the terms, they simply don't sign
them. When the statute
What's the gun to their head? What is the gun to their head? Why is it free and voluntary?
It's not free because people didn't get to vote who should have gotten to vote. Only the votes of the people who agreed with one side were counted. Everyone who voted against the waivers, their votes were not counted at all. Their votes didn't matter one bit. So there was no real decision among a neutral group of people as to whether the collective bargaining agreements should be waived. The only people who got to vote on it were people who agreed as a condition of their employment to agree to the waivers. So of course, there's nothing. You already knew the answer, the vote before it was taken. Everyone who's coming into this polling place has already signed a promise to vote for the Democrat or the Republican before they get in there. Ones allowed to vote.
But if the vote is, or if the innovation status is contingent upon the vote, how would those contracts, those pre-existing contractual agreements, be enforceable legally? In other words, the school district can't say, because you signed this, you must vote for innovation status. That wouldn't be legal, it seems
but
to me.
But obviously an individual who signs an agreement promising to agree to innovation status is going to agree. That's a pretty good bet. If you only let people come in to vote who sign statements saying they're going to vote for the Democrat, that's a pretty good indication that they're probably going to all vote for the Democrat when they signed a statement in advance saying that they would.
You say that the district is trying to get itself a better deal here than it got in the legislature.
Yes.
But aren't you trying to backdoor into a veto right on closing the school?
statute, we are trying to enforce the right that was put in the statute, that before a school can move down the road of an innovation plan, before they need to take a vote of the teachers at that school before the innovation plan goes into effect. That is the literal wording of the statute.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Sean Conley, together with trial counsel Brent Case, and we have the privilege of representing DPS. Also present in the audience are Superintendent Tom Boesberg and General Counsel Alex Martinez. Judge Berger, I'd like to start where you've homed in on, and that is DPS has the sole and undisputed right to decide whether to close a school. We cited the case law Hawkins versus Klein in our brief. Constitutionally, statutorily, it is their sole prerogative, the local board of DPS, to decide whether or not to close a school. In this case, they exercised that prerogative unchallenged, and they probably did so, not only because they had the authority to do so, but they had the responsibility to do so. When schools are failing, as the record makes clear, in the far Northeast they were, they had the right, for example, to close Old Montbello High School. That may be what's going on in the grievance here, but in terms of the Innovation School Act, that should have nothing to do with the analyses, because after they properly closed these failing schools, they properly decided to open new schools. And those new schools came into existence when they were approved and they got a new state identification number, and they were new in every sense of the way, regardless of where they were located. Some of the new schools were located on old campuses, some on new campuses, but each of the 11 schools at issue here, each and every one are new in every sense of the word. They're new names, new state identification numbers, new leaders, principals, new faculty, and new students. For example, when Montbello was closed, it was phased out so that an existing ninth grader on Montbello had the right to continue on to Montbello and graduate in 12th grade, but that school was then closed in a phase out. When a new school was opened, whether or not it was on the Montbello campus, DCISM happened to be on the Montbello campus. High Tech Early High was not on the Montbello campus, but each of these were new schools in the far Northeast quadrant, and they were entitled at that point, we submit, to apply for innovation status.
Mr. Connolly, when you use the word closed, do you mean the school no longer has any operations of any type? Because I'm confused between closed and phased out.
A phase out is a delayed closure. In 4 years, it will be closed forever. So Montbello High, for example, the board decided to close it. They did it on a phase out basis to provide the least disruption to existing students. So they decided in 2010 to close it, but it didn't close immediately. It closed 3 years down the road, or 4 years. A ninth grader would see it through and then continue on, had the right to continue on to 10th grade, 11th grade, and 12th grade. And then in 12th grade, the school would be closed when that ninth grader graduated.
But if it's still in operation, even though it has been closed in the sense that it's going to be phased out, I don't understand what the difficulty is in getting the buy-in of those teachers who are still working at that school, which is proposed to be the innovation school.
No, Your Honor, that school is not an innovation school. Old Montbello has never been and never will be an innovation school. It's a non-innovation school, and it will continue on that way. They opened then, in the far Northeast quadrant, they opened up six new schools, one of which was DCISM, which is a new school, new identification number, is not Montbello. It happened to be co-located on a Montbello campus. They opened collegiate prep in that area as well, and some were located on the old Montbello campus, some were not, but they are new schools. It is not Montbello. It is not Montbello in name. It is not Montbello in identification number. It is not Montbello in leadership and principles. And so the old Montbello people are not going to be voting on this because they are not affected by it.
But doesn't your argument ignore the difference in the statutory language in 3F, which talks about a majority? It talks about the public school, whereas the language in the provision that requires the 60% vote talks about the teachers of the innovation school. Doesn't that difference in language have some significance?
I think both 104.3F, which Your Honor referred to, and 109, which is a secret ballot, both talk about teachers employed at the school. And in the case of these new schools, the 11 new schools, there at the time of the innovation application, there was a new school. Contrary to my colleague's argument, a new school existed. It had been approved by the state. It had a new identification number. These 11 new schools did not at that time have any teachers employed at the school. Their argument is that you cannot literally comply with 104.3F because there are no teachers employed at the school. That's how I understood their argument. Seems like they reverted now to an argument they made in the district court that you have to go now to Old Montbello School and say to the teachers at Old Montbello, do you support innovation at a school that you don't teach it and you never will teach it? And that is not supported by the plain language of the Act or the purpose of the Act.
Well, 3F uses the term teacher, a majority of the teachers employed at the public school,
right.
Whereas 109 talks about the people employed, quote, at the innovation school.
Right.
Two different terms.
And I think that's understandable chronologically. If I walk through the, there are four sections of the Act that matter. 102 is the statement of findings and purposes. And replete there is the need for flexibility, empowerment, and contrary to my colleague's argument, it doesn't say we're trying to protect union interests or district interests. It says we're trying to empower teachers for the benefit of the students. And they may not have a lobbying group, but that's certainly the intended beneficiary of 102. 104, then, there are four subparagraphs. 104.1 is the paragraph that was relied here. A public school can apply to the district, the local district, for approval of an innovation plan. And under 104.1, that's what happened. Actually, 104.2 would allow the district on a top-down to have a school, ask a school to use an innovation plan. But 104.1 allows a school to apply to a district and district turn to approve an innovation plan. 104.3, Your Honor, that talks about teachers employed at the school, uses that phraseology, we suggest, because there is no innovation school at that point. That is simply an innovation plan has been approved by the local board, and then under 107, the local board then can go and apply to the state board for designation of as a district of innovation. And well, under 107, if the district submits that application, the state board designates the school under 107.3, at that point it becomes an innovation school. So only at the time of state board designation does it become an innovation school. And then Your Honor's talked about 109, at that point the state board has designated it as an innovation school. It is in fact an innovation school. But under 109.1b, to waive collective bargaining rights, it requires a supermajority vote of 60% of the teachers employed at that innovation school. So I think that in terms of chronological reason, that's the reason why 104 talks about teachers employed at the school, not an innovation school yet. It's simply an innovation plan that the that is being proposed and approved by the district and then in turn submitted to the state board. And then only under state board designation does it become an innovation school.
But right. At the time it's offered to the, at the time it's submitted to the school board for that approval, there is a school in existence that is named McAuliffe or Swigert or...
Absolutely. And it's a school with a state ID number. Now, it does not have at that time, it has a principal, you know, the district has said we want to empower a principal to come from a bottom-up proposal, say, what do we need to do to innovate here? What do you want to have done? It's empowered, consistent with the empowerment language of 102. It is empowered a principal, a leader, to form a plan and then propose that. So at that time, there is an existing public school. There is a school with a name and ID number. What it does not have are teachers employed at that school. The principal...
Well, Mr. Connolly, yeah. I think what's troubling us is that you've got a requirement here in 104 in submitting an innovation plan to the local school board for approval. It has to include certain things.
Yep.
Beforehand. These things have to be in there, in that particular document. And one of those is evidence of approval by the teachers.
Yep.
Okay. Seems like by necessary implication, then you have to have teachers. In other words, doing it after the fact, after approval of the innovation, doesn't comply with the timing that's in the statute.
Yep. 104.3, as Your Honor points out, requires innovation plan to have various information, and particularly 3F, I think, is what Your Honor is focused in on, and that is evidence of majority consent by teachers employed at the school.
Yeah, and it doesn't say unless it's a new school. I mean,
nope.
It makes no distinction.
Nope.
Okay.
Yep.
So why isn't the necessary implication then that there have to be teachers and staff? They have to vote beforehand, and their evidence of their vote has to be included within the innovation plan. It seems to be plain language at the statute.
We have two responses. One is, I think you have to apply the substantial compliance doctrine. And the question is, and the argument they're making, and their hook they're trying to hat on is, you have no teachers employed at the school, therefore you cannot provide that category of information, therefore you don't have a valid innovation plan, and therefore the state cannot designate this school. I think there's a lot of jumps there, but I think in terms of whether or not you comply with that one category of information, 104.3F, whether evidence of consent by a majority of teachers employed at the school. I think you have to look at the purposes of the statute.
But substantial compliance doesn't mean no compliance.
Well, I think in some cases it does. I think Judge Navarro's opinion we cited in supplemental letter to Wainscott, there was no compliance. There was a violation of a clear requirement in the hospital lien statute. In Meyer versus Lamb, which we've cited the Supreme Court case, it said a ballot shall contain a first and a last name of the person. Somebody in that case wrote Lamb, and they said it does not literally comply. You violated that. You didn't say Peggy Lamb. And the court said, no, it's substantially complied because you look at the purpose of the statute. What's the purpose? Purpose is to identify who they intend to vote for. What's the purpose here is to have buy-in and consent. And in this case, we said that we have buy-in. The teacher said principal said we're looking for people to support the innovation. We expect there's going to have buy-in. But now, after the fact, under 109, you do have teachers employed at the school, at the innovation school. They've taken a supermajority vote. And by far more than the requisite 60%, they've said we support this innovation. We want to waive collective bargaining rights. So now to go backwards and to say that since you could not comply with the 104.3F majority, evidence of majority consent, we're going to validate and say it cannot be done. I don't think the legislature wanted to restrict in that way.
Well, Mr. Connolly, yeah. But in the two situations, one where you have an existing school that's going to become an innovation school or wants to, and the situation where you close down and open up a new school, and before it has anybody employed there, it applies for innovation status. You've got two qualitatively different categories of voters. In the first, you've got existing teachers who are under no compulsion whatsoever, have made no promises whatsoever in terms of their employment, whether to support or not support it. And in the latter, you've got folks who have already agreed as a condition of their employment to support and vote for innovation status.
Well, let me disagree with that premise. I know that's the premise my colleague raised. There was no compulsion here. Nobody had to agree that. They were secret ballot votes, and some people, in fact, said we don't want to wait.
But you've got a self-selected group of people who agree with innovation status voting in the second circumstance, whereas in the first circumstance, of course, you don't know how they're going to vote. I mean, you've got two, again, qualitatively different populations voting in these circumstances.
But what's the purpose of the act? The purpose of the act is to have buy-in from people and make sure that these schools are going to have the buy-in and support for the requisite innovations. And you have, when you're interviewing people, a principal says, I want to seek innovation status. This is the kind of school I envision. You're telling people, do you share that vision? Now, if they can come in and say, openly, I don't want to waive my collective bargaining rights, and some have.
No, but the buy-in's by two different populations, isn't it? In the first case, before the plan is approved, it's by the teachers that are in the existing school, assuming there is an existing school. And then when you take the vote later on, then it's clearly by the statutory language, those people who are working or are going to work for the innovation school. But aren't those two very different populations?
No, in all cases, it's the people that are going to be working at the innovation school. In no case are the people that aren't going to be working at the innovation school, as they would suggest that you go to Old Mont Bell and say, do you support innovation in the school you will be teaching? And that's contrary to the statute, contrary to the purpose of the statute. I think in both cases, you're saying, one, admittedly, in a new school, you're saying requiring a prediction. You're saying that I suspect that there will be buying, and because we're interviewing people, and we predict there's going to be buying, and that's exactly.
But,
I think in this case,
but Mr. Connolly, isn't your proposed reading of this statute a way for the district to, if it wanted to, create an entire district of innovation schools? It could close down every school, and then reopen new schools without having taken a vote beforehand of any faculty member. It could do that with every school, couldn't it?
Well, let me just say, well, if it could, it can do it because it's power to close schools. And that's really the crux of the issue. I think it was Judge Berg was getting at the question. That's really what's going on here, that they cannot challenge a power to close schools. And in this case, it's probably upset because the district is not closing high-performing schools. They're closing schools that are failing their students. And that's the...
Well, that might be currently what they're doing, but things change, and maybe you get a school board that's not so sympathetic, perhaps, to the teachers and decides, here's a way we can get around all these collective bargaining rights for all the teachers. We'll just close down every school.
Well, you can't get around. You have to have buy-in. You have to have a, and that right to vote is under 109. And people at that school have to vote to do that. This is not a union protection bill, Your Honor. And the Innovation Schools Act, you know, when there's a lot of discussion that who is the lobbying group, lobbying group one, lobbying group two, and students don't have a lobbying group, this is a student bill. And then if you look at the purposes and the findings of 102, it's not union, it's not district, it's a local empowerment, and it's students. And the requirement and the absurdity of the result is, if they're right, then it's just a one-year waiting period. You can close the school, reopen a new one, get the buy-in, and hire the people that are going to support the innovations. You just have to wait 1 year to open as an innovation school. And that makes no sense. The testimony in the record, uncontradicted, is these family schools need to be opened as innovation schools immediately, not in day one, not in year two. And that's all you've done is a one-year delay. And
thank you, Council.
As far as that. Thank you.
And thank you to both counsel for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted, and a written decision will be forthcoming in due course.